Hello and welcome to another episode of the Hammer and Umpire Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Weber. I appreciate you tuning in. I know it's been a little while. It always seems like I'm saying that, but life is always seems to be getting in the way of doing these podcasts, though I do think about them frequently, weekly as it might be, and I appreciate the people that send in emails and contact me on Facebook and other social media outlets and let me know what they think about certain things. So I do really appreciate that. My baseball season's starting up this next week, and I'm excited for it, as I'm sure you guys are excited for your seasons to start as well. I hope for the weather to be good. I hope for some of my assignments that I'm excited about that they don't get rained out. You know, I mean, I like all my assignments, I guess. But, you know, there are a few that are a little bit more high profile than others that I hope take place and don't, you know, have a snowstorm or something like that. So I've got a few interesting things for you this week. Of course, I'm answering a few emails, and that's usually what I've been doing lately is I get your email and I save them all and I try to answer them within the podcast. So you'll see some of those as well. I've got three of those. I'm going to talk a little bit about a specific thing with three-man mechanics. I did some training sessions with some newer umpires for my high school association, so I'm going to talk about some of the things that came out of that. I had another email about a chirping coach, you know, in a particular scrimmage that I'm going to address that. Talk about working the wedge. I've talked about that before on the show, but I think it's always a good thing to reiterate and go over again here as the season's starting for many of us out there. And the biggest thing I've got is from our online Zoom meeting for my local high school association, which obviously I do a lot with. Our training is led this year by Mike Duffy, who is a College World Series umpire here from Grand Rapids, Michigan. And in this meeting, we had a little session and talked with one of our members, David Hedges, who attended Wendelstadt this earlier this year. He's a retired guy that decided to go down there, and he wants to be a much better high school and maybe even college umpire at some point, but right now high school umpire. And he talks all about his experiences. So I had recorded that Zoom meeting, and I pulled the audio from it. And you guys can listen to that. I think he does a great job explaining his experiences. You also hear on there another umpire from our association, Dan Ripma, who many years ago himself attended pro school. So he asked a couple of questions as well. So kind of, I guess, a guest interview. I've got three people on there that are from my area that are interesting guys that I think that you'll enjoy that conversation and make you think about a few things. And maybe some of you might want to consider going to pro school at some point. I know I would like to, but it doesn't really fit in my teaching schedule for sure. I've been very busy assigning baseball games. I, you know, do all the sub-varsity assigning, high school assigning here in West Michigan. Well, for almost all of West Michigan. There's a few other guys too, but I do a majority of it. And to help out with some of the varsity stuff. And it's been tricky. I mean, we are low on umpires. And I try to get two guys on every game. But it's been a struggle. And definitely some of my freshman games are going to be solo. And there might be some games that need to be moved because there's nobody available, particularly some of the freshman games. So I've got a couple dates there that is still a struggle. But the way assigning works, for those out there that do it, you know, you just keep plugging away at it. And more often than not, it usually seems to work out. But with our shortage in numbers, there might be some times where it doesn't. So I'm hoping that's not the case. But we might be moving toward that. The biggest thing out there, be good to your assigners, guys. Have your availability updated. If you get assigned a game, you should be taking it. Don't take forever to accept or decline games. Be the guy that you would want an umpire to be if you were assigning. You get too many guys. I get guys, man, that weeks it takes them to accept games. They don't communicate well. They don't check their email or whatever they're doing. I don't know, man. It just doesn't make any sense to me and frustrates, you know, Bruce Stone, the assigner that I work with as well, very much so. And he even sees that sometimes in college baseball when he's signing that. So it happens at all levels. But don't be that guy. That's the biggest thing, okay? So anyway, I think I've got some interesting segments for you, and I hope you enjoy it. And I'm happy to be back, and I will always be continuing to do this show. But sometimes, I mean, I'd like to do one a month, but it doesn't always seem to work out that way. I'll see what I can do. All right. Sit back and listen to another episode of the Hammer and Umpire Podcast. So I got an email from Andrew Tedesco. And he said, "Hello, Kevin. I'm brand new to being an umpire. Welcome, Andrew. Currently in class and have yet to work a game. Your podcast has been such a great help to me. It is hard to just sit quietly and read a rule book." Okay, now they ask, "The music that you play between segments is so loud. Can you try to adjust the volume so it matches your voice? It's only a few seconds of music, but in the car and especially through headphones, it is quite startling. Anyway, thank you so much for your hard work, and I will continue to listen with the intent to understand. All the best, Andrew." I will do what I can, okay? The music segments in between are from Anchor, and I use those to do the transitions, and I'll see if I can make some adjustments. No promises. Probably won't happen, unfortunately. I record it with my microphone, my pretty good microphone that I bought. It's not like it's a top-end one, but it's pretty solid. And I have, adjustments that I can use on my end for that. But the music is just like pre-recorded kind of things that they have set up within the app that I create the podcast. So I'll see what I can do. Nonetheless, I appreciate your email, Andrew, and hopefully you'll keep listening. And thanks for listening so far. And hopefully it's helpful, and you'll have a successful first season. So I got an email from Todd Bullinger, and it says, "Hey, Kevin, just started listening to the podcast and have enjoyed it so far. I'm actually going in reverse order to get the most relevant up-to-date information first. However, I was hoping for some additional clarification on a situation I had on the October 14th, 2021 podcast, Situation 10. You indicated on his stride the batter had his foot on the ground but completely outside the batter's box, but also indicated he hit the ball legally. I'm trying to understand the question a little better. If he hit the ball legally, his foot couldn't be on the ground completely outside the batter's box. And if it was completely outside the batter's box when he hit the ball, he would be ruled out, Rule 732. Fed rules here, guys. Hoping you can clarify a little bit better. Thank you, and thank you for the podcast." Well, thank you for listening, Todd. And I guess you can listen to it in any order you wish. I don't know if everything's always relevant. With the newer things, and there probably are a few things, but I'm sure some of the older podcasts have some very good things too. Anyway, that was a bit of a weirdly written question, and I believe the way I understood it, if his foot came down completely out of the box and he hit the ball, then you're right, it would not be legal. But I believe he's making contact with the ball, kind of like, Mel Ott style, I guess, with his foot a bit up in the air, but his stride does come down outside of the box, and then the ball bounces up and hits him while he's in the box. So you only have to have one foot in the box if it's going to be like a foul ball, it hits you in the box, right? You don't have to be completely out. You'd have to have both feet out and be in fair territory, and the ball hits you, and then you're out, right? So I believe that's what the ruling is, but it is not a very well-written question. I will definitely 100% give you that, okay? That's the way I interpret it, because when I read it the first time, I was a little confused as well, thinking, well, if his foot's completely out there, it's like, either you can be, stepping on the plate, stepping outside, you're in fair territory, then I believe that's what it is. So they're saying when he hit it. So to me, I guess I'm just insinuating into it that his foot was up in the air. It doesn't say that. But that's the way I interpret it. That's a weird thing. And I guess that's a complete judgment call as well. It's one of those things, if you've ever called that or had somebody that called it, I mean, I've called it too. You're right on top of it. You can see what's happening and see if the player is, out of the box or not. Or like if the guy's bunting and his foot's on the plate and that kind of stuff. I've been working the bases when my partner's called that. And, you know, when you're 100 and whatever feet away, you can't see that very clearly. But I assume every time, if I got a partner calling that play, he's right on top of it, and he must be 100% sure that that's what it is, even though you always seem to get an argument about the particular play. So, yeah, it's kind of it's not really a tricky call, I guess, because you do have a pretty good view of it, but it's a tricky one to sell, I guess, to the coach that it's going to be going against if they want to come argue about it. But basically, I say, hey, I'm right on top of it. I saw that 100%, and that's exactly what it is. I'm 100% confident in this ruling, you know, and then just go with it and get the game going, right? Don't let the guy argue it forever. So hopefully, Todd, that answered your question a bit, but I definitely see where you're coming from. And I hope you enjoy the other episodes, the past episodes, as much as hopefully you've enjoyed the ones you've listened to so far. Thanks.
So thanks, everybody. I'm Dave Hedges, and I've been asked by Bruce and Nick and the guys to just talk about my experience that I had down at Wendelstedt this year. I went to the 2022 Wendelstedt full pro course for 4.5 weeks. And the reason I went to is I just wanted to learn as much as I possibly could. Been umping for 3 years and going to clinics with West Michigan, and just really thought if there was a way that I could learn more, I'd really try it. And I'm retired, so I had the opportunity to actually take the time and spend the money and run down there. And it was a phenomenal, phenomenal time. It's split up. The first 2 weeks are for the beginners, I would say, and they basically just really reset you all the way back to the very first thing. We go through all the rules of the rule book every day for the first 25 days. And so starting with, you know, baseball is a game between two teams of 9 players, and just going all the way through the entire rule book. Morning session started at 7:30 in that ball classroom with 192 students this year. So there are 192 of us from all over the world. There were some guys from Belgium, from England, from Tel Aviv, Israel, Africa, and then all the U.S. and Canada, and a couple of guys. Yeah, that was it. Everybody pretty much all on the same page, all trying to get better. A lot of people looking to get pro jobs. Obviously, that's the intent with Wendelstedt, is if you want to get a job in Major League Baseball, you go through this course and then get invited to the advanced observation course. And at that observation course, then they pick the best guys to go. This year, there were 7 people that got jobs in minor league baseball out of the 194 that went through the program. So it was awesome. Afternoons were all on the fields. We had cage work. We'd have simulated games. We'd have innings. Innings were where umpires were playing the field. Umpires were pitching soft toss behind an L screen. And we'd have a base umpire and a plate umpire. And we would umpire every play that came along. And there was direct instructional feedback from major league umpires, minor league umpires that were on the fields with us. We'd usually have at least 4, sometimes 6 instructors on the field with us. And so there's 2 guys that are umping, and you're getting feedback from usually 2 or 3 guys that are coming and helping you out all along the way. So it was really, really awesome. I'd encourage anybody, if you get a chance to do it, strongly, you know, recommend it. I learned a ton. You learn the footwork for all of the mechanics. You learn, and they teach everything is two-man. It's all of the two-man mechanics are what's used in minor league baseball. So starting with the rookie ball and going to low A and then double A and high A and then triple A. I think at triple A, maybe they go to 3-man, but it's all 2-man mechanics. So it really applies to what we have to do. And you really get to learn all of the OBR rules, and then you can discern what the differences are for the high school rules. Anybody have any questions?
So how many hours a day?
We'd start up class at 8 o'clock in the morning. We'd get back to the hotel by 6 o'clock. It was about a 10-minute drive from the hotel, so you can imagine it was a full day. And then every night we'd have testing from 8 o'clock until 10 o'clock at night, online testing for the topics that were covered in that day. And then we'd have, I guess, three times a week, we had written quizzes. And on Saturday, we had written tests on Saturday and then a final exam at the end. And they add all that up and you have to score at least 70% in order to be qualified to get a recommendation to go to Major League Pro School. And that was a lot of head knowledge poured in over a 1 month period of time. And then the field work was all repetitions. And so, you know, when you're out on the field in the either the A, the B, or C position, you're performing and your crew. So there might be 15 other people that are in line ready to go for the next rep. You're doing mental reps when you're in line watching, sometimes even physical reps spread out on the field and getting feedback. And so you're really getting, I would say, 500-600 reps every day for a month on all of the two-man mechanics at every position in every circumstance. And they throw the book at you. I mean, you're at the plate umpire. There's catcher's interference, a balk, an obstruction between second and third with an overthrow going out of play. And then they ask you to blow that up and explain to the coach what you've got and place all the runners. And so it gets to be pretty intense. They help you through it, but there's complication. They throw as much as they possibly can at you, knowing that you're really never going to see that, you know, in a high school game, all of that thrown together. But we did have Ryan Addington, who was the plate umpire for the Pittsburgh Pirates Chicago Cubs game with Javi Baez going up to first base and back. He was the plate umpire for that. And so he explained to us what was going through his mind when that was going on. And the biggest thing he wanted to make sure happened was that Baez didn't touch home plate, because if he did, he wasn't sure if he knew what the right call was on that. He didn't want to have that be a strike against him, because he still hadn't been called up to the majors. You know, he had done 240 games up till that point, and he still wasn't a major league umpire full time. He just got promoted this year. But that was pretty crazy.
Yeah, I've actually had that play happen in a game. I was not the plate umpire, so I was glad I wasn't, because I didn't actually know. And I don't know how many of you guys know what he's referring to. It was the runner from Chicago Cubs ran towards first base. The first baseman caught the ball up the line away from the base.
Right.
And he basically got in a rundown between home and first.
Yeah. Which is basically legal. Right. Baez had a sharp hit to the third baseman. Third baseman threw it to first base. He was near the bag. He just had to step on the bag, but Baez stopped short of first base, looked at him and kind of deked him, and he started following him back towards the plate. And Baez was just kind of walking back to the plate, and the pirate guy kept following him back. There were actually two outs, so all he had to do was go touch first base, it would have been done. And he followed him all the way back to the plate and then threw the ball over the top of Baez to the catcher as R3 was coming in to score, slid. And then Baez went up to first, catcher overthrew first base, and he went into second. Then the right fielder overthrew second base and had the ball wound up at third. So Baez winds up on second base with two wild throws and a rundown. And he was legal to do that because he had not touched first base. Otherwise, he would have been running the bases in reverse order, making a travesty of the game, would have been out. But because he hadn't touched it, he wasn't running it backwards. But then comes the complicated thing. Well, what happens if he goes to first, doesn't get first base, but runs back and touches home plate? And at that point, he would have been out. And I'm not sure exactly why the ruling would have been on that, but they had talked about some intervening play, and it was beyond my over.
Yeah, and it is a third world play. I've had it once. And again, I was not the plate umpire, but it was a runner on first, guy bunts, and they throw it. The first baseman, I believe, picked up the ball and could have just turned around and walked over and touched first base, which he didn't. He followed the guy up the line. He threw it to catcher. Catcher threw it back to the first baseman. And all this time, the runner who was on first base ended up at third. Yeah. They finally tagged him out. And the coach was furious because he said that's abandoning, and it is not, because as long as he doesn't touch the plate or go beyond the plate, so if he misses it, it goes beyond the plate, he would also be out.
Yeah.
So if that arrests, man, you'll be a hero because you'll have the right call. Nobody will know what it is,
but yeah, you will know. The last thing I'd say, Mike, is that there were two guys that were there that were 75 years old. One of them, Dave Chopek, is still doing SEC games, Division I. There was a 75-year-old guy that is doing JV high school ball. There were a couple of guys that were in their mid-60s, and then me at 60. So we had, I think, six of us at 60 and over, and then probably 15 that were in their 50s, and the rest of them were all 18 to 30-year-olds that were all looking for jobs. But as the old guy, the ARP group, we had an absolute blast. It's very physical, very demanding, but it was worth every penny of my time and investment that we put into it. So I'd encourage you, if you get a chance to do it, don't think you're too old. We'll probably be going back again. Just to do it again and again.
Hey, what, Dave, how old was the oldest umpire there? I mean, excuse me, how old was the oldest umpire that you think officially got a job in the minor leagues this year? Do you know, by chance?
Oh, there was a guy, one of the guys the oldest one was in their 20s, probably 28, I think. And one of the old guys, in the second week, we got a letter that said, if offered a job in pro ball, would you accept it? And we had to sign that thing, yes or no. And I said, there's no way, because the timing of this thing is you go through this school, you get selected to go work in minor league ball. You're going to work 7 years before you get your first opportunity to do a major league game. And then it may be up to another 7 years before you actually make it to the pros. And so realistically, you need to be in your 20s so that you're going to be 35 when you do get called up to the bigs. So they wouldn't say that you were too old because they can't. They also can't tell you you're too fat like I am, but they do body mass index, and they do full physicals, full blood work, full medical once you make it to the evaluation clinic. And on that evaluation clinic, we had 28 guys from our class that made it to the evaluation. And there were 12 other direct invites. So there were 40 people in Vero Beach for the minor league contract offers from the minor league umpire supervisors. And 7 contracts were offered this year out of the 40 that were invited there. And then the other guys get pushed to the Appalachian League and then get opportunities in the Northwood Leagues and other leagues around that are not affiliated with Major League Baseball.
How much was it?
I wanted a single room so my wife could fly down to stay with me. That cost an extra grand. And I think for the class is $1,800 and it's probably another $2,000 for the hotel. So I think it's $3,800 total. And then I paid $48 plus the meal plan. So you can spend $5,000 going down there for the month. But you're on, they provide everything. And it was worth every penny. It was what I made last year in my officiating. You know, I figured I'm just rolling that over into continuing education.
Awesome. How many women did they have attend the school this particular session?
They had two women. Courtney was she's a Georgia graduate, a banker, and had worked in the banking industry for 6 years. She quit her job because somebody told her she should go be the first African-American female black umpire. She quit her job, went to school, did not get selected, went to UPC, which is the umpire placement course, did not get that. She couldn't do it. And then we had a immigration attorney that was also there. And so there were two women that we had to go through the course. And they made it through the whole thing.
Very interesting. I had two, and I attended in 1986. We had two women that attended as well. One of them did make it, but obviously she was a waitress, about 25, but she did not get a job or anything. She just went through the course.
Yeah, I'm not sure who she is, but there is a woman that's in AAA. I had worked with Tom, and I'm not sure exactly what's going on with that, but they're definitely trying to get females involved. But at the end of the day, your body of work that you stand on the field, you know, you can't hide a good umpire and you can't hide a bad umpire. You know, that's a quote that's on the wall, and you've got to be able to perform, and you're competing against, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people by the time you go through all the leagues and all the people that are going through the courses, you know, on a annual basis. So they're trying, but it's going to be a slow process.
Thanks, Dave. You know, it is, I don't think people understand that process. You know, it was probably the, if I had a dollar for every person who asked me after I did the College World Series, what's next, major leagues? I said, are you kidding me? Do you even know what it takes? At this point in my life, I'm 57 years old, and there's just no way.
Yeah, my appreciation for the umpires that are in the bigs, that are in the minors, that are in the system. I mean, the guys that make it, you know, those seven guys that made it, they're going to get 80 games next year in rookie ball and low ball and make $57 a game with no health insurance.
Yeah.
That's their summer job. That's the gig. And then you make it for a little bit, you know, you don't really make any money till you get to double A. And so it has to be your passion, and you're going to have to go out there and do it. I mean, if you're doing it for money, you're not going to go, you know, and it takes you 10 years. So you better not have a wife or a girlfriend.
And for all you guys out there that know Matt Wachowski, that's exactly what he went through. And he did go to the Appalachian League. Wasn't there a terribly long time before he got called up into affiliated baseball, where he's got a contract. And he's a guy that had a contract coming out of school. But they had, if you watch anything about minor league baseballs, they had that they cut down number of leagues and teams and so forth. Right. So they had less spots. And it's certainly a haul. And I've had the good fortune to work with a lot of guys who made it to AAA. Mark Yule's younger brother, David, made it. His process was 11 years. He could read the handwriting on the wall. And I love this story because he had full spring training, which means major league. He was making about $38,000 a year as a AAA umpire. And when he started getting full spring training, you get $38,000 for doing 6 weeks of spring training. He would then make $38,000 in AAA. And so his last year, he knew he was not getting picked up by the major leagues. Still did his 6 weeks, got his $38,000. And he said his last game was at Target Field. I think it was Minnesota versus the Milwaukee Brewers. There were 45,000 people in attendance. And the very next weekend, he was in college baseball at Michigan State. And he said, I think there were 45 people.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks, guys. Thanks, Dave. Appreciate that.
Yep. Thank you.
Well, last night I was able to do a little training session with some of the newer umpires in our high school association. We had a meeting out at one of the baseball and softball training centers where they have, you know, indoor cages and fields and all those kind of things. And that's where we do our clinics and stuff. That's what we have to do here in the cold weather states for those of you that are in those warm weather places where you can get outside most of the time. So we did some stuff where we're doing, like, you know, soft toss into a guy doing a, you know, a catching and stuff and calling pitches and checking it out for some of these brand new guys. I've got a couple guys that I'm assigning some sub-varsity high school games to that, you know, this is their very first year. So we worked on basic techniques for, you know, how you set up in a slot, and worked on head height and tracking the baseball with your eyes and not moving your head. And this was a bit tricky for a couple of the guys. And I had a second year guy as well that was working on that. And sometimes it was a matter of how they lock themselves in to their position to be, you know, consistent in their positioning and where their head height is, you know, throughout the baseball game. And, you know, it's just subtle movement sometimes with their head, like their chin's going down, they're following it. And I think, I noticed with a couple of guys too, it's because their head height is a little bit lower than, you know, their chin above the catcher's head there. And they're almost trying to subconsciously, I think, look through the catcher a little bit when they do that. So we made some good progress last night. But that is definitely something as I, you know, next week I have my first games of the season. Weather here is supposed to be okay, you know, maybe 45, 50 degrees, which is pretty good here in March. And when I call my first plate, I definitely want to concentrate on, you know, timing. The things I talk about with these guys, you know, the basic stuff, right? Timing, slowing things down, making sure I have my head height properly positioned, make sure I'm locking in well. Make sure I'm tracking with my eyes and, you know, certainly not moving my head or anything. All those basic things. I don't care how long you've been doing this. I mean, I've been doing it a good number of years now, but I know some of you out there have been doing it a lot longer than I have. And I think we all have to do that every year. We got to kind of go back to those basics, those things that you would teach a brand new guy. That's what you've got to do. So that's what I'm looking to do as well next week. So it was a good learning experience with those guys. You know, we talked, you know, they have, sometimes I guess you don't always think about, the basic questions that guys have. You know, we're talking about plate meeting, you know, how you take the lineup cards, what do you write on the lineup cards, how do you use the indicator? That's, you know, so we talked about, you know, not staring at the indicator and trying to be as subtle as possible with that and those kind of things. We talked about some plays that you might have around the play as far as, you know, guys being in the batter's box or out when they're hitting the ball, you know, a hit by pitches, you know, did the ball hit him? Did he hit the ball with his body? You know, those kind of things. How you signal interference, how you signal catcher's interference, that is, or maybe even, you know, a batter, you know, that is interfering in some fashion as well. And also check swings, you know, how to properly do that. You know, all those kind of things that sometimes I think us veteran guys kind of take for granted. But we've got to talk about that and make sure that guys understand the proper way that those things are done. Some little things, you know, talking about called third strikes, you know. So as guys were taking pitches and, you know, seeing balls and strikes, and, you know, we'd have them call a third, whether they're on the left or right side. And I've come to the understanding, or the opinion, I guess, that I like one step, or you know, one step called thirds. I don't like a two-part called third strike where you kind of do this movement and then that movement and then call it. I know there's some guys that maybe can get away with that. I mean, of course, you can do whatever you want. It's your style, I guess. But I like that kind of sudden, boom, you got it, whatever you're doing. And so we talked about those things too, and, you know, having guys go home and, you know, they got to practice in the mirror or something and see what they think looks good. You want to know that you're looking pretty solid when you make that call on a call at third, right? And also, you know, being able to track the ball, you know, using a tennis ball, sitting on the floor, you know, looking up at the ceiling, like on your back or whatever, and just tossing it up and tracking it. That's a good thing to do. And I know that David Hedges, who I've got on the program this week, they talked about that at Windelstat, being able to do that, which I think is a great exercise to do. Obviously, you want to do with a tennis ball because you don't want to hit yourself in the face with a baseball or something, unless you want to wear your mask, I guess. But that's great because your head's going to be solid right on the floor or whatever, and you can just use it for tracking, you know, tracking it just with your eyes. If you're a newer guy, that's a great thing to do. If you're a veteran guy and, you know, you haven't called some of your first games yet, and you want to make sure you're using your eyes properly, because that is what good umpiring is using our, being in a good spot and using our eyes properly. That's the number one thing. Then that one might be a good exercise to do before some of your first games as well. We talked about timing, you know, timing in whether it be, you know, on the plate or on the bases is always important. And as I share with them, timing and being too quick is the thing that gets me in trouble 99.9% of the time. Anytime there's something that I do that I don't think I did quite well, or maybe I messed something up, it's usually because I was too fast. I didn't let the play happen. I didn't let the pitch happen, whatever it might be. And those are things that, you know, I try to pass on to guys so that maybe they can avoid them more so than what I was able to do. So those are a few things I took away from the training session last night. It was pretty good, and it's always fun to give back to guys and let them, you know, learn from the things that you've learned over the years and try to make them a little bit better, because that's the whole point. Because, you know, I want the best umpires out there with me, and I'm sure you do as well out there. So we got to help everybody along to make sure that that happens so that we're all a good team every time we step out onto the field. So for a lot of the show, of course, we talk about two-man mechanics, which is great, and that's the basis of, you know, all the mechanics build on that. But I think this is a good time to talk a little bit about something with three-man mechanics. And I think I mentioned this before, but I think it's worthwhile for those that work a little bit more three-man out there. And I've been lucky enough to work a little bit more of that the last couple of years, and I've got some games this year that will be the case. And also, they're talking about, I think it might be a done deal, but maybe next season, the NAIA conference that I work here in Michigan is probably going to move toward three-man, which I think is wonderful, because I think three-man is just fun to work, and that gives also the opportunities to guys working that to get good at it, so that if you get opportunities to work some Division I baseball that uses three-man, then you're ready for that. And also you're ready for any conference tournament postseason kind of stuff you might get that uses three-man. So hopefully that goes through, and maybe some other leagues around me might do that as well. Anyway, one of the trickier situations for a three-man crew is when you've got a runner on third only and less than two outs, where that guy on third might tag up on a sacrifice fly or something. Because we've got the third base umpire, it's trickiest most for him. He's got to decide based on what the first base umpire is doing, whether he is going to stay at third and line up the tag up, whether he is going to come into the middle of the diamond because the first base umpire is going out on the ball, or whether he has to go out on the baseball if he's got a ball in his area that he's responsible for fly balls. So he's got three decisions to make, and they have to be made based on what other people are doing, notably the first base umpire. So in this situation, if you're the first base umpire, you have to be very clear and have some good communication, eye contact and verbal and gestures or whatever you might want to use. And this is obviously pre-gamed kind of things to make sure your third base umpire does not get confused and is able to get where he needs to be on that play. So basically, if you're the first base umpire, you're either going out on the fly ball because it's a trouble ball, or you're coming in. You're not going to stay right around first base and take your routine fly ball in your area. If there's a routine fly ball to right field in your area, then you're coming in and taking that catch, no catch, coming across the diamond where you can be in position to take the batter runner wherever he's going, and free that all up for your third base umpire. And so that should be very clear for him. If he sees you coming in on a routine fly ball to right, then he can line up that play at third base. Obviously, if you get a trouble ball yourself that you got to go out on, you know, fair foul, tricky catch, no catch kind of situation, then you got to go out hard and strong, and he knows that, and therefore he knows he's got to come across the diamond because he's got everything there potentially with that batter runner, and that frees up the tag up for your home plate umpire. And then obviously if you, as a third base umpire, are going to go out on a trouble ball for you, a fair foul or a tricky catch, no catch, then you go out hard and you already know that your first base umpire is going to be coming across, because if he's not going out, he's coming in, right? He's either he's going in or he's going out. And so you don't have to worry about that everything's going to be covered there as you go out, and then your home plate umpire will line up your tag up and, you know, for the runner at third base. So obviously this is something that needs to be discussed in your pregame meeting. But if you do it well, you look like $1 million out there. And, you know, hopefully you're getting evaluated or something, and they'll see that you guys have good communication and you know what you're doing and you know your mechanics well. And more importantly than anything, you're getting plays right and you're in the best spots that you can be to call your ball game. All right. So those are some things to think about, particularly if you are working some three-man sometime this year, about how you handle that runner on third with less than two outs. Okay. Let's talk for a few minutes about positioning at home plate. And as I think we all can agree, getting plays right at home plate is probably the most important spot on the whole field to get them right. I mean, we want to get them right everywhere. If you kick a call at second base, somebody's going to be upset with you, but it's the guy safer out at second. All right, I mean, it might cost somebody a run potentially. But if you kick a call at the plate, it's a run or not a run, one way or the other, that you missed. And that definitely is a more of a highlighted situation that we don't want to have, because those can end up in some ejections if it's a bad situation. So some of my veteran umpires, I'm sure, just like me, I guess, were taught first baseline and third baseline extended positioning when taking plays at the plate. And some of you out there may still be using those techniques. And I urge you to do a little digging and research on wedge techniques for taking plays at the plate. And you can also use wedge techniques on other bases, but, you know, we usually talk about plays at the plate. I know some of you out there are already doing that because this concept has been around for a few years now. But it's something that definitely our newer umpires out there need to look into. And it's something that we all should revisit as the start of the baseball season here. So the advantages that you get from using the wedge, which I'll talk about more specifically in a moment, is you get better views of swipe tags. And that's what most of the plays at the plate have become nowadays, because catchers are not allowed to be blocking the plate unless they have the ball, right? Otherwise, you know, we have some obstruction going on there. It also gives you better views, if you're doing it properly, of crash and block plays in front of the plate as well. And if you're doing it right with good timing and everything, you'll have a better view of any potential drop ball. All right, you're not going to get blocked out as much, and a ball might be on the ground and you don't see it because you got a bunch of bodies in your way. Okay, so that's all some good stuff. Hopefully that makes some of you out there think, yeah, that's good. I don't want to blow those things. So big basic things with this, you locate the ball. I've been taught that you start first point of the plate. You read the throw and what's going to come in and what kind of play you're going to have. Then you position yourself maybe 2 to 3 feet immediately behind the catcher, lining up with his left hip or his glove side hip. Hopefully we don't have a left-handed catcher out there. But if we do, that's just going to throw a whole monkey wrench into it. But, you know, 99.9% of our catchers are right-handed, so we're usually good to go. And then as you line up and stay on his hip, you are prepared to take a final read step to see the tag being applied. You know, a very purposeful step to get a good view of the play, all right? So this kind of contradicts some of our old school training where we were taught to be like 4 to 8 feet away from the play to maybe have a wider vision of the play. You see a lot of the wedge technique where somebody's almost really right on top of the play, and that's okay. Also, we were taught back in the day to not go into fair territory to take a play at the plate. But frequently with the wedge, if you're standing on the guy's hip and he's swiping and such, you might end up right in front of the plate, definitely in the dirt circle area out in fair territory, and that is perfectly fine as well. All right? It can be tricky to grasp at all, you know, but I always just tell myself, you know, I just get point of the plate, read it, and I stay on his hip, stay on his hip, stay on his hip, and just keep watching, and I usually just end up where I need to be from there. So you got to simplify it a little bit and not overthink it. That's usually the case with most things in baseball, right? So there's lots of good YouTube videos out there. There's been some umpire groups that have done some really nice things with this. You know, overhead angles and all kinds of stuff out there that I highly suggest that you look at, and then try to work this into your game the best that you can, and you'll get more plays right at the plate. You'll look like $1 million doing it as well. You know, it'll lead to some good evaluations for you, and most importantly, you'll nail those plays and get them right, even on some of those bangers that you can get at the plate using the wedge. You're way more likely to get that play correct. And that's the name of the game, right? So I had a listener email me, and he wanted to kind of remain anonymous about this particular situation. But I thought it was a very interesting situation and one worth addressing, especially with our newer umpires. And he wrote to me, so he said, "So I was doing a varsity level scrimmage game last summer with a smart coach chirping in my ear. I was behind the plate calling what I thought was a decent zone. In hindsight, possibly a bit too big for the level. The home coach expressed his concerns regarding the height and size of my zone. So I go to my partner in the field between innings and ask him how my zone looks. And he says it looks good, but you're stealing a few too many up in the zone. So I recalibrate just my head height and tighten things up a bit. Later in the game, the coach now decides to chirp that I'm not calling the high strikes anymore, and he's not consistent, which, you know, I guess maybe it looked that way, right? How would you have handled this? Should I have tightened up my zone at all? I made the proper adjustments to the zone and head height, and he then turned it around and was still complaining. I basically just ignored his comments after making my head height adjustments. Maybe he just saw the opportunity to rally a younger umpire. The opposing coach was young and experienced and was more focused on players and game, if that matters. So, I understand that. I think later on in the game there, since he was complaining about your zone earlier, if you're going to do a ball strike warning, you got to get it done early in the game. Let's say in the first two or three innings or so. If you don't do it, and now it's like the end of the game, let's say it's a 7-inning game, and it's the 6th inning or something, or it's the 7th inning of a 9-inning game, or whatever it is, you know, it's in the last third of the game, whatever that might be, you really can't do that. I mean, you should have taken care of stuff earlier. So my first suggestion is, if he was complaining about it, whether it was big or not, don't let guys complain about strike zone. Whether your strike zone is good or bad, they don't need to be complaining about the strike zone, all right? So you can say, "I hear you, coach." You can give them like the initial kind of, you know, off-key kind of warning. And then if it continues, then you give them the official ball strike warning where you take out your lineup card and, you know, you call time, take out your lineup card and say, "This is your official ball strike warning. if you continue to argue balls and strikes, I'll have no choice but to eject you, or something to that effect, okay? And you write it down, write something down, or make it look like you're writing something down. I always write down BS second inning, because, you know, ball strike, but it is a bunch of BS too. So it kind of goes with that. But anyway, you need to take care of that stuff early. So that's my first suggestion. If you feel like your zone is having an issue, and we've all been there, sometimes that's the case, then you do try to make an adjustment. Yeah, if you were calling a pitch in a certain location before and now you're not, it does look inconsistent because technically it is, okay? But if you're now getting it right, then I guess that's good, okay? I don't think it's good to call a pitch a strike that's a ball all game. I don't see how that's good, okay? If we're making that mistake, then we do it. And then you got to know, you got to own that. So if you feel like, yeah, that's the case, this guy kind of has a little legitimacy to do it. If he just makes one little comment or something, that's fine. If he's being a jerk about it and he's just continuing and he's kind of making a mockery of you or something like that, then you got to step in and take care of the ball strike kind of warning because you can't have that. But if it's a legit thing and you're like, yeah, you know, I just wasn't seeing the ball well. I was having a little trouble because I'm human, and I made an adjustment, but the guy has a legit beef here a little bit, and if he just lets it go, then I guess we're okay with that. So I don't really know how that was, if this guy was doing it. Maybe it's one of the first times he's seen you, and he's testing you a little bit. Guys will do that, especially the little bit older, more veteran coaches will do that at levels and see how you handle things. And sometimes, you know, the first time you basically take control, you know, I'm not saying you're going to be a jerk to him, but you're going to be like, hey, I'm not listening to the complaints about balls and strikes. I'm going to call it the best I can, and that's what it is, and you just need to deal with it. You know, that's basically the message you have to give to him in a professional way, that that's not what we're doing. You know, you coach your team, I'll call balls and strikes the best I can, and we're going to move on from there, and there'll probably be a few that you disagree with, and I don't need to hear about it, okay? So that's it. Height of the zone, okay? So at most levels, at least the levels I work at, you know, you got to be looking for balls below guys' hands, okay? So I don't know how high up you're getting it, but even at, like, let's say sub-varsity high school, I mean, you know, I guess if you're working some ridiculous game and it's like 15-2 in the third inning or something like that, and you're calling one that's under the armpits because you got to get some strikes, that's probably okay. But if it's a competitive game and the guys can throw with at least a little bit of speed here, you know, you got to keep it below their hands because that's really what they're taught to. And usually below their hands for most guys, especially when they're taking their stride and they're swinging, is usually the top of the strike zone. Okay. And that's usually a legit spot. We frequently do miss high pitches. A lot of umpires do. We don't call enough high pitches strikes that probably are strikes. Okay, so that is definitely something that's okay to get those high pitches. And when you, if you're a guy that gets them consistently and it really is a strike, you sometimes will get a little grief because other umpires don't get those strikes like they should. And so you're looking like you're calling a higher pitch. But if it's legit and you're consistent in getting that, then that's perfectly fine. So think about, you know, making sure, you know, you're tracking the ball well and it's below, you know, the hands, and it's a legitimate pitch that you might be able to hit and, you know, make something with it, okay? If you're calling it up by his shoulders or something, that's tough, especially if the guy's throwing hard. Same type of thing, and I was talking about this in my training session the other night. You know, if a catcher's sticking it right at his knees and of his shin guards, that's usually about the same spot for the batter, and if you line them all up, and those are usually strikes there. Also, for the high pitch too, even if it's a big catcher, if he's able to stick that ball in front of his forehead, right in front of his mask, that's usually a good indicator of the top of the zone as well, okay? So you can look for the under the hands. I don't know what is better for you, but under the hands, the forehead of the catcher where he's sticking it. If he's not sticking it well, then he's going to lose some of those high pitches because he's making it look like a ball, right? But if he can stick it right there at his forehead, frequently, 99% of the time, that's a strike. And that's usually at the top of the zone. So those are a few things to think about there. But very good question, and that's something that's tricky for a lot of guys, you know, and something that everybody's dealt with. So nothing to be, I guess, embarrassed about or anything like that. That's what we got to go through to become better. All right, thanks for the question and sharing that with me. Well, there we go. Or you got another episode of the Hammer and Umpire podcast in the books. Once again, thanks for sticking with me and listening all the way through, because you got to this point, man. You've been listening for a little while, and hopefully you enjoyed this particular episode. Like I say, the goal is always to get an episode or so a month, but sometimes it's every 3 months. Okay. But, you know, maybe sometime I'll do 2 episodes in a month. You know, I used to do it, try to do 1 a week, but that gets a little tricky. When it was big time COVID times and I was stuck at home on a computer all the time, I could knock out a few more episodes. But I'm teaching, you know, full time as I always do. And I'm at school doing my thing and other things are going on in my life. And I don't always get to sit down and do these podcasts like I would like to. But I will not be giving it up. I still enjoy it and I get good feedback from people. And I know that it is beneficial to some people out there. And there's always some new people finding the podcasts and listening to them. So I do appreciate that quite a bit. If you have any questions or comments, please contact me. I've got some information there in the show notes here on the Anchor app and everything, and the Anchor website. SpinalFusion06@yahoo.com is my email. Shoot me something about a question or a comment about something in one of the segments. Sometimes, you know, I say something that maybe isn't quite accurate. I try to be as accurate as I can, but I have people point that out to me here and there, and I try to address it. And if there's anything that you think would be a good segment, let me know. I do get some good ideas from people, and I try to incorporate those in the best that I can along the way. I always like it when people give me a good suggestion, because I know at least one person out there wants to listen to that, okay? So that's good. Sometimes I do a segment, I think, well, I don't know. Hopefully people will like this, okay? And I try to get something that will be beneficial to a good number of you out there that are listening. Obviously, I try to gear some things toward our newer umpires. I think that is a bulk of my audience. But I know I have some veterans out there that listen as well, and I try to gear a few segments here and there toward them. And as someone that's, I guess, considered a veteran myself, I think that even if I think it's always good to go back to basics, you know, even if you've been doing this, you know, you're a 20-year guy, just talking about basic technique for working the plate, for working bases, basic mechanics, all these kind of things, we all have to, like, have those things re-ingrained into our brain so that they're good habits again every year, because we have to reprove ourselves every year. I don't care what accomplishments you've had. I've been lucky. I've had some nice accomplishments so far in my umpiring career, and I'd like to have many more. But this year, 2022, I got to prove myself all over again, and so do you guys. So don't ever forget that. There's no game that's bigger than you, and I don't care what levels you're working. You will go out there and give 100% every time. And you never know who's watching, because frequently there are people, or who's filming it or where it is. And you do the best you can every time out there until you hang it up and walk off the field. All right. So until next time, especially on these new games out there when it's cold, you guys in the cold weather area, keep calling strikes.